Hey everyone, and welcome back to Inside the Morgue. We're your hosts and lovely autopsy techs, Jess and Alice. And this week we are joined by a very special guest, Dr. Eric Hanberg, aka the Forensic MD on Instagram and TikTok. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Of course, we're so excited to have you.
Well, I'm excited to be here. I'm very excited to try. This is a hodgepodge setup, as you watched me try to set it up right now.
So to kind of kickstart this little interview, how long have you been a forensic pathologist?
So I've been a board certified forensic pathologist for about a year. I've been a forensic pathologist in general for two and some change. And I started my anatomic pathology residency in 2018. So I've been doing autopsies since then, but I've been doing autopsies specifically in the forensic setting since 2021, somewhere in there.
Very cool.
Oh, nice. I've been in the field since 2022 also, so about the same time doing autopsies. So what made you pick forensic pathology specifically?
So I started in emergency medicine. So I went to medical school certain that I was going to do neurosurgery. I had done a bunch of undergrad research stuff in neurology and neuroscience and ultrasound neuromodulation and a bunch of other big technical words. And it sounded really fun. And then I got to medical school and I met an emergency medicine doctor named Larry Beskind, who was awesome. Really, really inspirational guy. He also apparently was the roommate in college of Trey Anastasio, who is the guitarist for Phish. I don't know why that matters.
That's a cool fun fact.
And he really convinced me that emergency medicine was awesome. And I did all of my rotations and did everything to do emergency medicine. And I ended up doing it. I ended up matching to emergency medicine residency at Northwestern in Chicago. And I did that for a couple of years. And then after a few years, it just sort of clicked that it wasn't for me. I didn't enjoy it the way my colleagues did. I just didn't see a future in it. And I considered, do I want to finish this residency just to sort of finish it? Or do I want to drop and career pivot now? And I talked to the program director and I talked to one of my mentors who was a toxicologist. He's just a really cool guy. And they both separately recommended that I look at forensic pathology. And they both said, I'm not so sure you're going to like pathology, but I think you're going to like forensic pathology. And I thought, well, I don't know. The guy who taught it in my med school was real weird. And I don't know if I love that. But I checked it out. And when I read about it, it really did sort of check the boxes that I wanted to get out of my medical career. It got me using a lot of sort of broad knowledge. I really like the idea that when I learn all this stuff, I get a chance to use it again. Because a lot of times, you know, if you go into pediatric cardiology, you really kind of hone down to, you don't use all this random knowledge that you gained through infectious disease of weird stuff, or what do these street drugs, what are they called, what do they cost, that kind of stuff. You don't ever use that knowledge ever again. I mean, I'm not saying that's a bad job. Obviously, we need them, but I like using the broad knowledge, and that's one of the main things that I get out of this. So the more I looked into it, the more I sort of decided, yeah, that's what I want to do. And when I went into pathology residency, I sort of showed up saying, I'm the forensics guy. I'm going to do this. And I really took a special interest in autopsy. And in doing so, I became better at it, and getting better at it made me like it more.
That's awesome. That's such an interesting story.
Yeah.
Like two separate people telling you to get into it. And you're like, all right, maybe I'll give it a shot.
Yeah. Well, at first I'll say I fell in the same category as most people. Is when I heard it, I was like, what are you guys saying about me personally? It felt like maybe they were being judgmental or something, but the more I learned it, you know, they weren't, which was actually, that's been a lesson to me that there is that stigma about forensic pathology that, you know, forensic pathologists are sort of weird.
Oh, yeah.
And the more and more I've met forensic pathologists, there are certainly weird ones, but there are weird everybody's.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've found out there's a big array of, or a big, I don't know what you'd call it, like a widespread spectrum of people that do this job, and I feel like I really enjoy it.
Yeah,
I love that. I Jess and I talk about it a lot because we're pretty happy, upbeat people, and when we tell people what we do for a living, they're like, "Oh, I can't picture you doing that." And it's like, "Well, why? What are you saying?
Right?
What's your idea of someone who does this? Because you're probably wrong."
Yeah. Well, that's one. So people say that a lot. Normally I get asked, what is that, right? That's, yeah. Nobody knows what it is. But then once they find out what it is, I think my favorite question that people ask me is, aren't you afraid? Like, aren't you afraid when you see all those dead bodies? And I love the idea that I would go into work every day and just be like, you know, that's so funny to me. Obviously I'm not, and I'm not afraid of the bodies, but the idea, people find this so spooky.
Yes.
And I just don't, ascribe
to that. Absolutely. I always get that. And I also always get asked, what's the craziest case or the grossest thing you've ever seen? Which is so, I'm so over that by now.
You know, I have this love-hate relationship with that question, because I think most of the time, I think it comes from a good place, or at least that's what I've been telling myself lately.
Yeah.
Is that I think that there's this thing in people where they want to remind themselves that there's this spectrum to the world and give themselves a chance to remember that they're living this really privileged life where there's not a ton of violence, and that all of this true crime stuff they see, that's real life. And it's a good way for them to remind themselves how good their life is. Or at least that's how I'm telling myself to look at that question.
I like that spin on it, because I don't mind when people ask me, like, what's the grossest thing you've seen? But I always feel a little, and I'm probably reading too much into it, when they're like, what's the worst case you've ever worked? And I'm immediately thinking of all, like, the traumatic cases that have, like, stuck with me, like pediatric cases and stuff. And I'm like, why do you want me to trauma dump right now? I'm trying to have a drink at a bar.
Right.
I'm trying to relax.
Well, and totally, I think that that's why I came to this conclusion about the question, is because everything in medicine is sad, right? And broadly speaking, there's a lot of happy stuff that happens in medicine, but for the most part, medicine's a tough job. And, you know, radiologists tend to be the first person to see a cancer in someone. Somebody showed up and they thought, my arm feels weird. And they do an X-ray and they go, oh, shit. Mm-hmm. Or sorry, am I allowed to curse on here?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So they see some mass. And so this radiologist, with all their training, goes, this 22-year-old is about to have an entirely different day than they thought they were going to have. And pediatricians almost always see healthy kids, but they're also almost always the first person to see someone become an unhealthy, sick kid. And that's tough, but it's only us, or at least it's predominantly us, that get asked that question. What's the worst thing you've ever seen? Could you imagine asking a pediatric oncologist, oh yeah, what's the worst thing you've ever seen?
I was just going
to
say that.
That'd be crazy to do. And nobody does that.
Like, I can't imagine.
Yeah. Well, so that's
what
makes me think that's them recognizing that we see stuff that most people don't see. And we see this broad array of stuff. And I think that's them trying to come to grips with the idea that it's out there. And I'm trying to look at it in a positive light, because I know there are those people who watched Faces of Death when that was out in the 90s and things like that. And there are people who do sort of fetishize violence, but I don't think that's most people.
I agree.
Yeah, I definitely think, like, everybody's watching, like, all of the true crime TV shows and, like the detective shows. And they have, like, an idea of what an autopsy is and, like, what happens. But then they meet us and they're like, oh, like, what really happens?
Which is why we have a podcast.
And they're just fascinated around it.
Yeah. That's one of the things that I used to feel really cool in the emergency room, is if you tell people that you work in the emergency room, they want to hear your stories, right? Everybody wants to hear a story about something you found in someone's butt, and they want to hear a story about when you saved someone's life. Those are, like, the two main stories that everyone wants to hear. And usually some story about a drunk guy or something. But if you have an emergency room doctor and you have a race car driver and you have a helicopter pilot and you have a neurosurgeon in a room, everyone has amazing stories. But when a forensic pathologist gets there, people want to hear what I have to say more. I don't know what it is about this job. I think it's maybe that sort of fascination with and fear of death or whatever it is, but people love it. They love hearing about what we do. And I'm really proud of what I do. I also think it's cool. So I love when other people think so too.
Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely.
Like, I got into this because I used to be that person who, if I ever met somebody who was like, yeah, I work in forensics, I'm like, tell me everything. Like, tell me all about it. And now I do it. And I'm like, okay, I hope I wasn't annoying.
Well, you know, we've all been there. That's good. It's interest.
Yeah.
I learned through, so I also do a podcast and I interview other medical examiners and I find out what they were like sort of in their process. We don't talk about medicine. We just talk about who they are, because I always found it so interesting. And I have found out there is this subset of forensic pathologists that really do hit that stereotype. Patrick Hansma, if you happen to know who that is, he really does hit the stereotype. And he thought all of us did. And he said something like, yeah, I mean, I was just like any other forensic pathologist. So when I was in high school, I read Edgar Allan Poe and yeah, I hung out in graveyards. And I was like, hold on, not all of us were like that, man. But there is this subset that's like that. Hey, but that's okay. I don't have a problem with it. I think that it's interesting. It certainly was not me. I was just too busy being weird in other ways. I was still testing out rollerblading, stuff like that.
Oh no, you just described me. Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, I was definitely the stereotypical. I had like Edgar Allan Poe, and I was also really into like zombie stuff and like the Walking Dead comic books and all that. And, like, I was reading that in the hallway at school, all edgy.
I'll tell you the truth. That would have been too scary for me. So I saw The Ring when I was in high school, and that was the last horror movie I saw until this year. I can't handle the gore.
The Ring is pretty scary. I'm a big horror movie fan. The Ring is up there.
I'm trying, but honestly, the gore is too much for me.
Okay, that's interesting. I've talked to other like forensic pathologists that we work with, and a lot of them aren't big horror movie fans. And since working in forensics, I still love horror movies. But
I feel
like,
that.
I've gone to watch them less. Like, I don't seek them out as much because I'm like, I saw this all day at work today. Like, I don't need to see this more.
Mm-hmm. Well, that horror movie thing, I think that falls in the same category of, I think a lot of the reason people like horror movies is because they remind themselves of how good their life is. Like, this is what I would do if I were in that situation. And also, I'm not in that situation. I'm in a real nice apartment, not worrying about murderers, you know?
Yeah, I'm sitting on the couch and, with my popcorn.
You don't have to find that access to that world through movies anymore. And so, you know, there's that. But honestly, for me, I just think a lot of it's gross. The movies, like, it makes me feel queasy, and I don't love the way they make blood look in movies. It's kind of
gross.
Yeah,
it's hit or miss.
Speaking of movies and TV shows, do you have a favorite like crime scene drama that you like to watch?
Oh my gosh. So I have always been a big fan of the Sherlock Holmes mythology. And so I really liked all the Sherlock Holmes iterations. Some of them are definitely problematic. Like, if you go back and read the books, they're shockingly bad sometimes.
I haven't read them in a while, but yes.
I won't repeat it, but people will know what I'm talking about if they read the books. And there are a lot of iterations. The BBC Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch is very good. I like that one a lot. But my favorite iteration of Sherlock is the show Elementary, which, if you've never seen it, it is, what is his name? He was the first husband of Angelina Jolie. He was in Trainspotting. He's got three names. I can't remember, but he plays Sherlock Holmes.
Not Billy Bob Thornton, is it?
No.
That was like three names?
Following
like
husband. No, but that's true. That's similar. But he was the guy in Trainspotting who shit the bed. But regardless, he plays Sherlock Holmes, and he does a great job. But what makes that iteration so good?
Johnny Lee Miller?
Is Watson. Yes.
Sorry, I just Googled it.
Yeah. So Watson is played by Lucy Liu.
Yes.
And that's super cool for a couple of reasons. One, because she's awesome. But another is that's the first female Watson. And that put them in a bind because Watson is typically a total sycophant and borderline useless. But they can't do that with the first female Watson. So they had to make her thoughtful and useful and smart. And it's so much better. It's so much more fun to watch when she's actually, when the Watson character is awesome. So she is independently a fun character to watch. And it also follows the typical, police procedural sort of setup. So each episode it's got a little string of storyline that goes on, but for the most part, they're standalone episodes. And, you know, you have this sort of superhero kind of super brain. And that one's fun. As a side note, I also really liked House. That's one of the shows that got me through
House is so
medical
good.
School. And that's also the Sherlock Holmes mythology.
As soon as you said iteration of Sherlock Holmes, I thought you were going to say House.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a good one. I got quite a few questions right on my medical school tests based on House episodes where I was like, I don't remember from studying, but I do remember the episode where.
Yes.
And so I would get questions right on my exams.
Love when that happens.
So I'd say that's probably one of my favorite sort of general crime shows, but I have a tattoo for the show Psych. If you've ever seen the show Psych.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I've recently started watching it. It says jerk chicken.
It says jerk chicken. And my best friend from medical school, we would get through really stressful times in medical school by watching Psych. And in Psych, when they get really stressed, they get through it by eating. And oftentimes it's jerk chicken. So one of them will suggest some food and the other one will say, you know, that's right. And they would get jerk chicken. And so I have this pineapple that says jerk chicken and he has one that says, you know, that's right.
That's awesome.
Incredible. I love that.
Thank you.
I recently just started watching the show. I'm still in season one, but we did an episode about Psych. We watched an episode of Psych and talked about it on the podcast.
Oh, really? Which one?
It was super early on.
It was, I can't remember the name of the episode or like what season it was, but like there was a funeral director involved that ended up, spoiler alert, being the killer.
It was season 6, episode 14.
Yeah, so she was the one who, that was the one where there was also the murder bookstore.
Yes.
Yeah, sure. And so the guy who plays Woody, who is the forensic pathologist, I met him at a Home Depot in Los Angeles. And I was like, hey, I would normally not do this, but I have to say, I loved you in Psych, man. And that's, you know, that's what I do. And I have a Psych tattoo. And he got so amped about it. And he took a picture of my tattoo. And he said, I love meeting psychos. And he tweeted it out to the world. And I was like, ah, there you go.
Oh, that's so fun.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was real fun. But I definitely remember that episode. The guy who runs the bookstore, he is the same guy from Third Rock from the Sun. And such a great show. Love that show.
I know. I loved that episode so much. I was like, all right, I got to go back and watch a show. My brother is also a huge fan of that show. And he's like, how have you not watched it yet? I'm like, I know. So,
oh, very good. Very good.
Yeah.
One of our coworkers is a huge fan, too.
Yes, and Casey loves that show.
She was like, oh, my God, you have to keep watching it. And I was like, well, they don't have like too much that we can talk about, but it's still fun to watch.
It's so fun to watch. So I noticed on your Instagram and TikTok, you do your forensic pathology pop quizzes, which I love. They're about all things forensic pathology.
Oh.
But my favorites that I was scrolling through were when you talked about movie deaths. You did a couple of my favorites. You did Freddy Krueger, Nightmare on Elm Street, Jaws, and Scream, which is like my all-time favorite movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering, I know you just said you don't really love horror movies, but do you have a favorite scary movie or a favorite like movie death scene that you think is the most accurate depiction?
Oh, boy. So two very, very, very different questions. So I did just start trying to watch horror movies because I fall into that category where I go, you know, I must be wrong, right? There are so many people that love these movies and they're smart people with cool lives. There's no way that I'm right and these 100 million people that love the movies are wrong. So I'm like, I want to try it, but I keep grabbing for ones that are popular and I start it and I go, this was not it. This was not the one I should start with. And so I finally asked for help from some people who really know what they're doing. And I've gotten some guidance as to like, okay, let's start here and we'll try this one. And if you like that, and we sort of have progressed from the sort of 80s campy, silly ones to the classic like Halloween and those ones. And then we threw in Scream, and I will say Scream was really fun. But the parts where it got like thrillery with the phone call, that actually was quite scary for me. So I was like, this is riding the line. But that I remember being younger and Ghostface was a legitimately scary villain. I had never seen the movie, but the idea of the big black cloak and this like really wild face, the movie is ridiculous. He is one of the funnier villains I've seen in
any
movie.
He's just a high school kid running around in a Halloween costume.
I laughed out loud at him multiple times.
Sorry.
Oh, I mean, spoilers.
It came out in 1996. 20-year-old
movie,
everybody.
But yeah.
Sorry.
Gosh, Atlas.
Yeah. Oh, God, 30-year-old movie. But that was a good one. So I will say right now my favorite movie that falls in the horror genre, according to the categorization on IMDb or whatever, is probably They Live, which I really liked that old one. I was delighted when I saw the opening credits and Rowdy Roddy Piper was the star of this movie. What that was life-changing for me. But it was actually a very good movie. I really enjoyed it. And it was scary, maybe a little bit, but not really. So I really enjoyed that. As far as sort of true horror movies, I did just see one called... Gosh, what was it called? It's one where like demon chases kids who have sex, and if you have
it follows.
So I actually really liked that movie. I thought that the cinematography and the coloration in the movie was beautiful, and the story was pretty cool. I liked it, and the deaths were not gruesome, and it didn't feel like fetishization of violence and fetishization of pain in the same way that the later Evil Dead movie did. But Evil Dead 1, super fun. Loved that. But this, I watched Evil Dead 2013 just a couple weeks ago. And I was like, yeah, that was definitely the other side. That's not the ones that I like. As far as portrayals of death and dying, so I have a unique viewpoint. I never have, luckily, you know, knock on whatever you want to, I have never had to watch someone die violently. But I have seen a lot of people die in a medical setting because I worked in the intensive care unit in the emergency room. So I saw people die. Now I've seen a lot of people post-violent death in this job. So I don't know that I'm really expert at saying what an accurate depiction of violent death is. But I can say I thought that the autopsy of Jane Doe was actually quite accurate looking. I mean, there was some stuff when they peeled the skin back and it was very homogenous looking and she had absolutely no body fat, which is kind of maybe true for that actress. I was like, well, that part wasn't super real and they did a weird incision.
They can never get that right in shows.
Well, I know a few people in the movie industry who practical effects like that are very hard. Very, very, very hard to do. And so I was pretty impressed with that. And I would say overall, that was a pretty good depiction of an autopsy. It's not accurate, but it's a lot closer to accurate than many other depictions.
I love that you said that because we watched it for a past Halloween episode. I think it was like our 19th and 20th episode. We did a part one, part two, and we watched the movie. We loved it, and we know one of the pathologists that we work with was like an assistant forensic consultant when in London for the movie.
Oh, so really cool.
We love that movie, and we thought it was like one of the more accurate depictions.
Yeah, of what we've seen with like cheesy crime shows and stuff. We're like, okay, well, this is pretty good.
When I was watching it, I don't remember what specifically it was, but when I was watching it, I noticed, I was like, well, obviously they had a consultant because that was too accurate to be someone's guess. And that's not something that you would think of. And it was just, it was something little. They probably wrote, you know, cardiac valve measurements on the board or something like that. I don't remember what it was, but it's just one of those things where I could tell somebody helped. And a lot of times I go, why don't they just ask? Most of us would just tell them how to say the word for free. You know, they never do. And they mispronounce things and it just immediately takes you out of it or takes me out of it. But who cares? That's not the point of the movie, I suppose.
Yeah, I always say on the podcast that they could just call us. I'm like, call me. I would love to help you guys. Hollywood, just call me.
I'll do it. You don't even have to pay me. What kind of advice do you have for anyone that's listening to this episode right now who wants to get into the field of forensics?
Oh, wow. Okay. So in general, I think a good place to start is that forensic pathology is a portion of the field of forensics. So I am the doctor in the room and I do autopsies and I am that person, but I have a huge team of people that I work with and they do awesome stuff. And a lot of it I can't do. So if you want to be in forensics, but you don't necessarily want to go to medical school and then residency and then fellowship and have the debt and all the responsibility that comes with it, there are other really good options in the field of forensics. So forensic entomology, forensic anthropology, ballistics, you know, crime scene. There's so much. And a good place to learn about it, I always pitch the Reddit. So there's reddit.com/r/forensics. And there's a ton of forensic professionals who are really open to discussing what they do and why they like it and what their job opportunities are and how they get to do what they do. And I think they even do like open question Fridays or something like that. But if you do want to do what I do, then my big advice that I give to everyone that's going through the medical training process is it's like some of the hardest advice to hear and some of the hardest advice to take. But in order to become a forensic pathologist, first, you have to become a doctor. And you really need to do it right. Don't become a doctor thinking, I'm only doing this to become a forensic pathologist. You need to learn how to be a doctor. And if you can get yourself to focus on whatever that next step is, if you're a pre-med, don't spend all of your time just thinking about and doing forensic pathology and only watch forensic pathology and only learn skills associated with forensic pathology. Become a doctor. Get into medical school and learn how to doctor. And then after that, get into residency and learn how to be a pathologist, because you really need to be a good pathologist in order to be a good subspecialty pathologist, which is what I am. And it sucks. It sucks to have to do all that stuff that feels like you're wasting your time. But the bottom line is it will make you better and it will make the process much more fun and much more fulfilling. And I mean, you know, like it or not, you might find something that you like more, and being open-minded to that is great. But, you know, I would never say don't do what I do. I love what I do, but I love what I do after having loved everything that got me here. So I guess that's the advice.
I love that. One of the pathologists we work with, so we have a lot of interns and students that we work with at our office, and one of them was like a pre-med student. He said, he's like, oh yeah, I want to do, like, I know I want to do this. And one of the doctors even said, he's like, don't go into it with that mindset though, because you might find something you like more, or that, like, and he's like, you need to be a well-rounded physician, yeah, not just.
Yeah, I'm, that's a really good outlook on it too.
So it's, I love that.
I mean, it'll make life a lot easier, and it's a very long road, and there's a lot of idioms and irritating sort of sayings in medicine. Like, it's a race, but it's a marathon, not a sprint. And it is all of those things. It's all true. And it is a brutal process to go through. But if you can find a way, find some purpose in each step, it'll make it so much more fun. And it has the side effect of making you a much better doctor at the end. So it's a win-win, but it is frustrating.
What's your podcast? I want to give a shout out to everybody listening.
So it's called Becoming a Medical Examiner, and right now it's on Audible and Spotify and Google Podcasts and basically everywhere that isn't Apple Podcasts, because I can't seem to get them to approve it for some reason. I don't know if it's content or what, but I'm trying to get it put on Apple Podcasts. But it's called Becoming a Medical Examiner. The first episode, I interview myself for a full hour, just talking to myself out loud alone in my apartment about how weird I am. And then all the subsequent episodes, you don't have to listen to me. You listen to me about half as much, because I interview someone else about what it was like for them becoming a medical examiner. And I really have found a lot of just diversity in the type of person that can become a great medical examiner. And that's been really nice for me. It's also been a nice way for me to meet my colleagues and get to know them a little bit better.
That's
super cool.
Hey, thanks.
We're also going to link your TikTok and your Instagram in our show notes so all of our followers can find you.
Okay, cool. Oh, and then I just wanted to tell you guys something. If you haven't seen it yet, I'm part of this new project that I'm actually really excited about. I don't know what it's going to mean for the world, but it's going to happen whether we do it or not. So I might as well be part of the people that do it. Is one of my colleagues, Dr. Paul Uribe, and through his company Dead Man's Hand Forensics, has created an artificial intelligence medical examiner. And
whoa.
I have been playing with this thing. You can go, if you Google DMH Forensics, there's a little chat bubble, like you would ask for help from the paperclip in Word. There's a little chat bubble, and that's the AI. And I have tried to get it to give me misinformation, and it's pretty good. And it's very
That's
fun
crazy.
And especially for stuff that is just facts, What is a petechial hemorrhage? If you ask it, it gives a good answer. And once in a while, you can trick it. And sometimes it gives answers where you're like, well, that's not especially helpful, but it's, you know, it's a computer. But it's pretty fun. And it's been super helpful for coming up with a nice, clean way to explain fundamentals. That's a fun tool to use. So if anybody wants to try it, it's free and it's fun. So you guys should try it. We're gathering data on it. It's not for research. It's, well, right now it's so open, we don't even know what to do with it. It's just figuring out what to do with it.
All right. And tell me again, where do we find that? How do we find that?
So if you Google DMH forensics, it's Dead Man's Hand Forensics. In the bottom left corner, there's a little bubble that says like chat with us or something.
That is insane. That is AI.
You can just ask it something. So pick some question that you get asked all the time and ask it.
That is so interesting. I had no idea this existed.
Well, it didn't up until last week.
It's crazy how fast technology is like is advancing for all different types of fields.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, I don't know if it's good, but it's happening whether it's good or not. And so hopefully we can try to make it good, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I like that. It's happening whether we want to or not. So let's try to be on the good side of it at least. All right. Well, now we just talked about how it's the worst question. But what's the craziest thing you've ever seen that you're able to talk about?
Yeah. So basically, the only reason I hesitate on those questions is because it's important to me that I always remember that these are real people who went through a real trauma and with real families that obviously don't want to hear their loved ones' trauma put in some sort of positive spin. So with that respect there, I can say that I've seen things that have been these massive traumas where your brain doesn't even, or at least I should say my mind doesn't even sort of grasp the level of trauma. While I was in training, I saw someone who had been hit by a vehicle so hard that when their portions of their body were brought in separately, and I found one of their testicles inside their ankle, which was separate. And that's just,
oh my gosh,
that's an amount of trauma. Ooh. That there's no sort of place for that in my mind. You don't mm-hmm. think about that can happen. And so that's pretty wild. For me, it's less about the findings at autopsy that I find so interesting. Most of the time, what I find the most interesting are the stories that come from the investigative reports. And that's why I really like going to crime scenes. I do it as much as I can feasibly within the caseload and, you know, how my day is going. But right. I like to go to scenes. And some of those stories are so incredible. And I get to go see the way that people live. And sometimes it's extravagant. Sometimes it's absolutely astonishing, the situations people put themselves in and the decisions people mm-hmm. make. It's just really wild to see that. And so you see people that are before I went to fellowship, I had the fellow before me told me that he had to take a fan boat in the middle of the night over a bunch of gators to the site of an explosion. And I was like,
that's
a pretty cool night on the job. You know, like that's pretty fun.
Yeah.
And ultimately, you know, when you find a body associated with an explosion, it's typically just, you know, charred remains. And it's not necessarily interesting from that standpoint, but the story is so interesting for me. So that's when I think about something crazy, I usually think of that. And then I think of very stereotypical medical findings that are perfect according to the textbook. So somebody who has every sign and symptom and then had all the exact complaints that they put in the quizzes. And then when you do their autopsy, that's exactly what you expect to find, and it's there. That's really cool. Mm-hmm. I think it's interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not, you know, I didn't kill them by my interest, so I don't feel badly about being interested in what killed them.
Yeah. No, I always find that, I don't know if satisfying is the right word, but when I, like, read the report and then I look at them externally and I'm like, all right, I bet we're going to find this when we open them up. And then you find exactly that. I'm like, I knew it. My education is paying off. I knew it.
I think that's okay, right? That's what we're supposed to do. And I think everyone in their job does that. I think that there's gratification mm-hmm. in using the knowledge that you've gained. Otherwise, all of us would be pretty miserable in these jobs.
Yes. That's what I always say. You really have to love this field. Otherwise, you're just like, I can't imagine working in this field and not liking it. Like, that's just horrendous.
I'd be miserable every day.
It's one of the things that I think is really unique about this field that I really, really appreciate is that I wake up and I went to a ton of school to get here. I had to amass all this knowledge. And so it kind of makes sense that I must love this job, right? Otherwise, who would do this? But so I wake up happy and I go to my work and I'm happy about it. But what's crazy about this job is I go work with other people who do other things there that are also happy to be there. And when we talk about work, everybody complains about working too much. We all want to work less and make more money. That's going to be true no matter what. But when we talk about the work, we're talking about it because we actually want to. It's not problem solving. It's not troubleshooting. It's, oh my God, can you believe this? This is amazing. Yep. Mm-hmm. And that I've never worked in a situation with people who are so genuinely excited to be doing what we're doing. That's awesome. And it's so fulfilling to be there and be excited about something and tell someone and have them get just as excited. That feels so good.
Yeah. I think when I first started, I met Jess and I met everybody else in the office, and I found out that they loved this as much as I did. And I think I said to Jess on my first or second day, I was like, I found my people. Like, these are my people.
It makes going into work so much better because everybody around you also wants to be there. Instead of just them dreading going into the office every day, you're talking about things that everybody else is interested in. Like, we find something really cool at the autopsy, we'll go up front and tell our deputy coroner investigators, oh, we found this. And their faces light up. They're like, that's so cool.
And you know what? It goes even the other way for me is I will have investigators who are very busy take time, often after work, they'll take time to come to me in my office and say, hey, that guy that was from the bakery or from the farm or something, what did you find? Because they just want to know. They want to close that case in their mm-hmm. mind. And God, it's so nice to work with people who care. That feels so good.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's incredible.
For sure.
I love it.
Do you go on scenes in your office? Or is that more for the investigators?
No, so I don't go to every scene. The investigators certainly go to a lot more scenes than I do. And oh, thank God. I just don't have time, right? And when it comes down to it, I do know how to do scene investigations. But if I tried to do everything, it would be overwhelming. And I'm so happy to have these excellent scene investigators that do it. So they go to a lot more. But they have been really good, especially lately, because I've made a point of telling them I want them to do this. Is they've been really good that when there's a scene that is especially weird, especially high profile, or if it's just something that they feel like they might benefit from having a little additional medical knowledge on scene, they'll come let me know. And most of the time, if I've got time, I'll say, I hop in the truck with them. And I'll be honest, when I'm there, I try not to do much. I try not to step on their toes. I let them answer the majority of the questions. I let them run the scene to the best of my ability. It's hard not to step in sometimes because it's so exciting to be there. But I do go to scenes, and it's so interesting. I mean, gosh, one of the big frustrations of this job is finding it so interesting and knowing other people find it interesting, but being hamstringed about talking about it due to the legal matters. And so it's frustrating, but mm-hmm. I'm sure everyone who is interested can certainly understand why.
Yeah. Cause we don't go to scenes. We're starting to go to a little bit more scenes, help out a little bit more, but typically we just stay in the morgue. But one of the first things I always want to do is I want to look at the scene photos. Cause like you said, sometimes it's fascinating and sometimes it's very helpful in the case. I'm like, oh, they were found in this position, so that's why the liver mortis looks this way. Or That's why their rigor is this way.
They're laying on their left side. That's why their left lung weighs more.
Totally. Well, number one, it's great that you guys are noticing that and caring about it because it makes it so much more interesting to do it. But there's so much to scene investigation that I find so interesting. So Miami, where I did my fellowship, that is, they're sort of known for being a place that really prioritizes teaching doctors about scene investigation. And we had a whole week-long workshop just on photography and learning how to take good photos. And so now it's so fun when I look at those scene photos, I notice, oh boy, they really should have used a flash. Otherwise, it makes it sort of look like an art photo. And I'm not looking for an art photo. I want to see what's on the counter, right? Like, it's just, there's so much more mental effort that than just walk into a room, snap a picture, and walk out again. It doesn't work that way. And when you see all the pieces come together and you can really, when someone does a good scene investigation, it adds so much to the case. And I can go in feeling so much more secure about the conclusions I make from an autopsy. It can be something as small as, you know, opening a cupboard and noticing that among the spice rack, there's some pill bottles. And then if they go as far as to take a picture of the label, I can then see, well, the label says those are supposed to be hydrochlorothiazide, but those look an awful lot like Viagra. And it's strange they're kept in the spice cupboard. I wonder whose name is on the bottle. And all of a sudden you start going down this path that I maybe wouldn't have otherwise thought about. Right. And that's so cool to me. I just find that the investigative part is so fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely is. I love it. We have a lot of great investigators that are very good at their job overall, obviously. And like the photography part and like looking at the photos, like I just said, is always really helpful. And we're very into our photography in the morgue. And we've heard about Miami being very into.
I've heard so many good things about Miami's photography.
So we always have like a blue background. We do organ photos. We white balance everything. Yeah. So we're into that.
We've elevated our photography game for sure in the last year.
Do you guys have a photographer that you, like an actual photographer that's their only job there? Or do you?
It's us.
It's us. We alternate. So we're both full time. And we do like a primary, we call it primary secondary system. So like today, Jess was primary. So she was cutting and I was doing the photography. So she did the dissection. I did all the organ photos and the toxicology stuff. And tomorrow it's my day. So Jess is going to do photos and all that. So we take turns.
There's so many little fun gadgets. I could go on about this, but have you ever tried infrared photography?
Yeah.
Jess has. Yeah.
Do you do it for tattoos?
We did it once for a tattoo.
Yes.
That is the best. It is crazy. In a decomposed body with it that's just sort of slimy and you can't see anything. Everything is green or marble black, you know, and you just can't see anything. You take an infrared photo with a really dense blocking filter. And when you take the photo, you just see tattoo. There's none of the marbling, none of the anything else. It's just a clear tattoo, and it works so much better than scraping off the epidermis. And it's just, it's such a cool thing to be able to do. And it really feels very CSI, like bones, right? I mean, it's not a hologram, but it's still cool. Like it feels very tech and very cool to do stuff like that. And I have sitting over on my counter right here, a little toy I got. You know what? No one will see the recording, but I'm just going to grab it anyway. Hold on.
Do it. I want to see it.
So I just got this thing from Amazon. This was like $100 and it is a microscope that this objective.
Oh, cool.
Is awesome. So I just took a quarter and I could see like the etching edges on the date on the quarter with this thing. It was $100. And this is just a dissection microscope. And so I'm going to take it in and show, and it's got a cable that'll let me plug it into a television. And so I'm going to use it to show coronaries to everyone in the room, right? I can show the techs, I can show the students.
Watch us go buy that.
And I'm blown away by this thing. It's so cool. And so there's so many little gadgets and things. Oh, you definitely should. It's so fun. I mean, you know, it's $100, so it's not perfect, but it's not bad at all. And for showing off coronaries or, I mean, even just being able to get a clearer picture, sometimes stuff is very small and being able to see it larger. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why neurosurgeons, they don't just look at the brain. They have it projected on a 70-inch screen. Right. And this is so cool. So I'm big into stuff like this. I try to bring tech into the morgue when I can. You know, a lot of times it still comes down to a scalpel, but.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah, we love photography and we love everything that we do in the back.
Oh, that's so cool. Now I can't stop thinking about how much I want one of those things. So I guess another question for you is something we also really talk about a lot on the podcast is like mental health, especially in the field, like with what we see every day. So do you have anything you do to help like after a long day at work? Like, do you have any hobbies that like I like to draw and paint? So if I have a long day at work, sometimes I'm like, all right, I just want to draw or want to go to an art class or something. Or I also do special effects makeup. Sometimes I do that, but that can also be scary sometimes. So I don't know.
That's really cool. Weirdly, I just today was saying, I don't think I could do my own makeup. Not that I have other people do it, but I just don't even understand the basics. And it's one of those skills that sort of half the population has and a lot of the time very well. And I don't even know where to start. Probably foundation, just based on the name. But
yeah.
So as far as
YouTube helps me a lot.
Okay, that's a good point. That's how I learn a lot of stuff. I should just YouTube it if I ever decide to start doing makeup. As far as mental health stuff for me. So when I have a hard day at work, I would say that the biggest help that I have is I will go talk to the people at work. So I do well talking. I like to talk about when things are bothering me. I like to talk about when I like things and when I don't like things. And so if I have a hard case or I recently had a phone conversation with a family member who a decedent, and it was a tough case. And I had to talk them through findings and I had to talk them through the lack of findings. And it was a very difficult phone call. And when I hung up, I was pushing on tears. It was a hard call. And I walked out to the investigators and I told one of the investigators that, hey, listen, I'm struggling with this. This is what happened. And he said, oh, I remember that case. And then there was this other case that was like that. And we started talking about that and just sort of helped to talk about it. So my main coping skill is just having people to talk to, especially people at work that I know where I'm coming from and they know the type of person I am and they know why I care. And so that means a lot to me. And I always encourage people to, in any part of medical training or when you work as a doctor or you do really anything in medicine, it's important to have a support system because you don't know when and you don't know how, but you do know that it's going to hit you at some point. And Dr. Francisco Diaz is the chief medical examiner in Washington, D.C. And I just did a podcast with him and he said something really interesting that I've thought about a lot since he said it, which was that it doesn't really matter if you've seen that exact situation before or 100 times before, because you're not the same person today that you were when you saw it before. So it might affect you differently and that's okay. So be ready to handle it anytime it comes up. And that meant a lot to me because you go, well, I've seen how many 25-year-olds that have been shot. Why should this one bother me? But maybe it does. And if it does, it's okay to go ask for help or it's okay to take some time to do something, to paint, to do your makeup, whatever you want to do. Mm-hmm. And it just was nice and validating to hear that from someone with so much experience that sometimes stuff does get to him. So for the most part, I would say I am pretty good at compartmentalizing. I can keep work at work. I can be very serious in the morgue and very silly at home. It's not really that hard. But if it ever does get hard, I do really like that I have people to talk to. And I also, I watch funny TV shows. I sometimes will paint. Mm-hmm. I like to cook. I do stuff that makes me happy. Work makes me happy a lot of the time. But if it ever doesn't, I have a lot of other things that do.
Exactly. Yeah. I love that.
I agree a lot with that. We have an amazing support system at work. And Alice and I, we're each other's person. So we just talk about everything. Because we're the only ones that kind of get certain things, but we always have everybody up front in the office to talk to. And I think that's huge for us, having that support system.
Yeah. It's definitely like I can come home and I can vent to my fiance about a bad day at work, and he's amazing, and he's going to listen to me, and he's going to support me no matter what, but there's only so much that he can understand, because he doesn't work in this field. And so talking to someone who gets it and who's seen it, and like you said, who's like, oh, yeah, I've had a case like that before. It was really hard. This is what I did. Like, that's something you really need in this job, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I always... I always joke whenever it's Jess and I aren't together and there's a day off and I have a hard day, without fail, I always end up in tears. And I'm like, and our office manager is like, why does this always happen when Jess isn't here? And I'm like, I don't know, because I can't talk to her about it now. But everybody else is always there for me too. It's just always funny. I'm like, Jess, you can't leave.
I can never take a day off.
I always cry when you're gone.
No, prioritize your mental health.
Yes. Yeah. I always tell that to our interns, too, because I feel like a lot of that, for our interns, it's like their first peek into forensics at all. Their first, a lot of the time, it's the first time they see a dead body. And I always tell them, you can talk to any of us, because I guarantee you we've felt what you're feeling. And we're not robots. We've worked this a lot, so we might seem like we're compartmentalizing a lot in the back, but like, if you ever need to talk about anything, we're here. We're going to get it. Like, let us know.
That's really nice. And you know, that didn't used to always be the case. And I've heard from a lot of older doctors that just nobody ever talked to them like that. When I was very lucky in that at my anatomic pathology residency in Oregon, our autopsy director was a guy named Peter Dr. Peter Stenzel, and he was 82 years old. And that really sounds like the kind of guy who would have no problem not caring about me at all. But it was the opposite. He was so caring. And anytime we had new students, new residents, anyone that came through, he'd come through on the second day. And I mean, he's kind of it's intimidating when you're new in the field and you have the director show up and he's got an MD and a PhD and he outranks everyone in the hospital by 30 years. You know, he's been there for a long time. And he comes in and he says, how are you doing up here? And everyone says, oh, good. I'm doing good. Thank you. And he goes, yeah, but how are you doing? Are you sleeping okay? Did you have nightmares? Are you still eating? And stuff like that. And just the fact he cared meant a lot. And it also kind of opened the door for me to say, it's okay to ask people that, like, remind each other that we can be professional and have human moments. And so it's kind of nice. I like that we're taking this, this field in that direction where, you know, we all take it very seriously, but we also recognize that we're people. And so sometimes you gotta take a step back. Sometimes you gotta go get a snack, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that a lot of the times, like, people on the outside think that we are robots and we don't have, like, emotions, and it, like, almost mental health kind of, like, falls to the back end of everything else that's happening in the world. So we were very big on making sure that our interns, our staff, everyone's good.
Mm-hmm. And I remember when I first started, so I had worked in a cadaver lab before, but I'd never seen, like, an actual autopsy and all that, and I was very conflicted because I was dealing with a lot of new emotions coming into it. And I knew I loved this job, but I thought having certain feelings, like feeling sad about a case or just like being drained mentally, meant that I wasn't like cut out for this. And so I wasn't talking to anybody about it because I was like, oh, I can't tell anybody how I'm feeling because they're going to think I'm not good for this job. And like, I love this job. I want it, but I can't tell anybody that I'm feeling sad today or they're going to think I'm not tough enough. And then I eventually just couldn't bottle up my emotions anymore. And I had to talk to somebody, and people at work were like, oh yeah, no, we get that totally. And I was like, oh, okay. That's good to know.
This is normal.
Yeah. It's absolutely normal. And it's also part of gaining experience. And for us, medical school, residency, fellowship, that's all part of the training. It's maybe a sort of hidden curriculum behind the other stuff. But you gain this resilience. You gain this ability to do the hard work despite that it's hard, not just intellectually, but emotionally. Mm-hmm. And it, you know, it's funny when you step back and you look at it, you go, well, obviously it's okay to feel that way, right? It would be crazy for someone to be like, I always wanted to be an astronaut, but they put me in the thing and I passed out at 10 G's, so I'm not cut out for it. You go, well, no, of course not. It takes a little bit of time, right? There's some training associated with it. And so I think it's reasonable to not be able to, and there's no way to kind of soft jump into an autopsy.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. You just see one and that's it. There's no training for 3 weeks to see one and do one. You just sort of do it. And so,
you gotta jump in.
Sometimes your first autopsy is a tough one and that's okay. And it gets better over time. I mean, at least you become better at dealing with it over time.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause like you said, you're not the same person you were
for sure
the other day. Yeah. Yeah.
5 days ago or 5 weeks ago.
But yeah, thank you guys so much for having me on the podcast. It was really fun.
This was great. This was really fun.
We had the best time talking to you. Thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to talk to us and be on our episode.
Nice meeting you. Nice talking
to you.
Thank you.
It was great meeting you. Great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Inside the Morgue. If you enjoy this podcast and want to learn more about forensics, keep on listening. You can find us on Instagram at Inside the Morgue Pod, and feel free to DM us anything you want to talk about. We'll be back next week for a brand new dissection. Bye!